Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. It's a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today, my guest is Ann Preciado-Rich. She's the author of Cosmic Headphone. She was born and raised in Los Angeles' San Fernando Valley. In the mid-1970s, she moved to the North San Francisco Bay Area to enroll in the psychology program at Sonoma State University. However, having found a much more interesting education in the local nightclubs and bars, she never finished her first semester. Instead, she found work as a seamstress, fitness instructor, cocktail waitress, bartender, and radio disc jockey before she at last returned to SSU to obtain a BA in psychology with a minor in marketing. From there, she landed a job with a local television station producing commercials and selling advertising. 7 years later, she gave it all up and once again returned to SSU to continue the research she had begun many years prior. Aside from working as an administrative assistant in admissions and records and the Department of Biology, she received her master's degree in psychology, taught psychology classes for 3 years, and laid the foundation for this book and two others. She also returned to radio for a brief time before moving north to Oregon, where she now resides. And Anne also is beginning her own radio show on this network, on srbroadcasting.com, which is Spiritually Raw Broadcasting. And now I'd like to welcome her. Anne, are you there?
I'm here, David. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for pronouncing my name right. That's great. You know, it's so rare.
Well, I had some help from a mutual friend, Mary Blake, who had interviewed you. So
Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad that she cued me in on the right pronunciation. So how are you today?
I'm doing quite well, actually. Thank you.
Good, good. Well, are we all set to talk about your book, Cosmic Headphone?
I think so.
Good. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, Cosmic Headphone is a paranormal fiction memoir as told by a young girl, Zoe Lynn. Well, actually, she's not young when she's telling it, but the first book is about her younger life on Earth. Despite her great reluctance, she was actually asked to return to Earth as a female in this life and is sent on a mission along with many others to help humankind begin to heal the ages-old conflict between spirit and matter, between mind and body. Particularly in Western culture, there's been a tendency to think of the body as less than divine. So Zoe Lynn is here to help rectify that misconception. Her, yes? Are you going to ask me something?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
No,
I was just going to continue. Her story is about growing up in the tumultuous years of the 1950s and 60s amid all that civil rights brouhaha. And the ongoing threat of nuclear war. It's a very intimate story, sometimes magical, sometimes difficult, as are all of our personal stories, delving a little bit deeper into, especially into some of the strange prejudices we have learned about our bodies and sexuality, especially women's sexuality. And along the way, she gets help from a group of higher-minded, somewhat playful, eccentric spirits who actually reveal to her many of the lost mysteries about women and sexuality. They also help her face a dark wound from her own ancient past, which she doesn't want to look at, which she actually needs to learn how to forgive in order to heal herself and thus to help heal Earth. But as we all know, forgiveness is not exactly the easiest lesson on Earth to master.
No, it certainly is not. And it sounds like she's on quite a mission. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about sexuality, women's sexuality, and I also relate to conflicts in sexuality as a gay man and coming to terms with that. So I'll be very interested in reading the book. Why is she reluctant to return to Earth as a female?
Well, there's a couple reasons. She's actually been to Earth 332 times prior to this life. And those lives in which she has lived as a man, to her, always ended up were better than those that she lived as a woman. The lives that she lived as a woman always ended up worse, or so she believes. So generally speaking, I mean, when you look at our history here, Earth has been rather tough on women over the ages. Ever since the great goddess, the divine feminine, fell from grace thousands of years ago, this is pre-Judeo-Christian Bible stuff, thanks mostly to the rise of that those religions, and also some warrior tribes and some certain earthly, you know, events that happened that kind of chipped away at the worship of nature and goddess.
I'm wondering, yeah, what are the patriarchal religious beliefs that were at odds with nature?
Well, Buddhism was one of them, surprisingly enough.
Okay.
There was an ancient Buddhist sect, the Jain Buddhists. It's I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation. It's J-A-I-N. They were very against any kind of physical desire. They thought that that detracted from spirituality. And then the Judeo-Christian beliefs, I mean, that whole switch at that time, I mean, the goddess was worshipped for thousands of years prior to this. Mm-hmm. People don't really realize that. They think that the Bible was the beginning of time so many times. But no, mm-hmm. There was all kinds of stuff going on before this, and there was a lot of goddess worship, and a lot of it was based on ignorance. Because at first people thought that it was women's menstrual blood that gave life to, that created life. They didn't realize there was a sperm and an ovum that, you know, the man had and the woman had that did this, so that created life. So there was all this suspicion and magical thinking coming up around women and the fact that they gave birth and the fact that their menstrual cycles were connected to the moon. But in the interim, there was a lot of brutal customs that happened during that time. There was a lot of sacrifices, human and animal sacrifices. Men were castrating themselves in ceremonies to honor the great goddess. So there was the downside of that. And with the advent, especially of the Judeo-Christian religion, they kind of came and threw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, they kind of just wanted to get rid of everything that had to do with ancient goddess worship. They turned it into something evil, and they thought nature was evil. There was a big schism that happened at this point, that nature was, anything of nature was evil. And even I've read that the fathers of the Christian doctrine, those people who developed Christian doctrine early on, believe that if we could all die out, we could all go back to heaven. But women kept having babies, so, you know, they got really kind of angry towards women. It was just kind of a crazy thing. And sexuality, anything having to do with sexuality, it was just so crazy. It's really crazy when you consider that's how we all got here in the first place.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a fascinating guest on who was a Jesuit who was expelled by the Catholic Church because of his beliefs around sexuality. And he wrote a book called Sex as God Intended. And his premise was that sex was not about procreation. It was God's gift to us as a source of pleasure and joy. And it does seem, you referred to doctrine, and it does seem like some of the early church fathers kind of perverted some of the teachings of Jesus, which didn't cast judgments.
Exactly. You know, it's St. Augustine is the one who actually came up with the idea that the reason humankind, the reason that Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden was because of sexual desire. And he's the one that came up with that little bit. And it had to do with the fact that when he was young, he got his mistress pregnant. Mm. And he didn't want to be a father, and he didn't want to be a husband. So he left and eventually came up with this doctrine. I mean, he wrote in his journals that he had a huge conflict about how his mind and body could create a life that he was not interested in fathering or being a part of. And this caused a big schism in him, which he passed on to the rest of the Western culture. Yes, it's just crazy. You know, if people could go back, and this is what I've tried to do with my book in part, aside from it being a fictional tale, I did do a lot of research into ancient history and mythology to find these little gems that surprised me, actually. I had no idea of this stuff before I started writing the book.
That's interesting. Fascinating. Can we talk just a little bit about Zoe and what she discovers along the pathway as far as the practice of goddess and pagan religion within the, you know, current times?
Well, as I mentioned previously, she's got these spirits that occasionally come and tell her all these weird little things. So she learns that, as I mentioned previously, how we came by this whole goddess worship, which was kind of based in ignorance that people didn't really realize what created new life. They didn't really realize that there was, that the man and the woman played an equal role in it. So there was all this worship around the menstrual blood especially, and the goddess worship. The goddess was the real big entity early on in human culture. There's some interesting things that happened as a result of that. I mean, you know, that's where we our Easter celebrations kind of come out of that. In the book, I mentioned how cross-dressing, the earliest cross-dressers were men who, in order to obtain some of the wisdom and the knowledge that the gods had given women, would dress up as women to appease the gods so that the gods would give them some of that magic and wisdom as well.
Mm.
That was pretty trippy when I heard that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Even Saint Jerome from the early, he was one of the early Christian forefathers, used to dress up as a woman. And they've tried to kind of, you know, kind of smooth it over in his biography and stuff like that. But there's no denying it. There's historical evidence. I guess he wrote or something. I'm not sure what happened, but they have writings that indicate that, yes, he was one of these cross-dressers early on.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of research.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. You know, one of the things with my book, I was like a two-year-old. It's always like, why have we come to believe in this stuff, you know? And as I wrote, the more I started writing about Zoe Lynn's sexual experiences early on as she's growing up, she learns a lot of prejudice. She gets in hassles with her father over it and stuff like that. The fact is, human beings are sexual beings from the get-go.
Right.
You've ever been around a five-year-old? Five-year-olds are very sexual beings. I'm shocked at some of the things I've seen five-year-olds do. Because you're just not, in this society, you're not conditioned to that. Plus, we have all the stigma around sexuality. So,
yes, we do.
And again, it's crazy because it's how we all got here in the first place. And, you know, Jesus, he never talked about a heaven being any place else other than on earth. Heaven mm-hmm. was on earth. Heaven on earth, you know. And it was the Christian church, I believe, who pretty much, I'm not sure what the Judeo early beliefs were, but they were the ones that put heaven someplace other than earth. And the only way you could get to heaven, which is the part of the schism between spirit and matter, is to die. The only way you could be in harmony with God and heaven and stuff was to die. But, you know, even St. Augustine, his father was a pagan, his mother was a Christian. Even he early on said that, you know, heaven could be known in all things. It could be known in a babbling brook, in an encounter with an animal, in a mundane conversation. So, you know, he wasn't a bad person. He just had issues and conflicts that got passed on to everybody else.
Well, that happens.
Yeah.
I believe heaven is here and now. And that's our eternal birthright, is the given moment as it passes along, and that eternity is inconceivable. We've always been here. We always will be here, whether we're in a body or not. That's my belief.
I agree. I totally agree. And, you know, it's a matter of if we can tune into it or not. Now, just imagine, so you're going to this church that has this huge influence over everybody is saying that we cannot have heaven until we die. I mean, what kind of life is that? That's
right. Crazy.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Well, why would we be here in spirit if you know, this is just a horrible place?
Yeah.
I mean, why aren't we all just all committing suicide then?
Right. Well, let's get back to your book. You mentioned that forgiveness isn't the easiest lesson to master. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, how many times have you seen a movie where the evil villain gets, like, beaten and killed at the end? And you root for their demise all the way. I've done it. I catch myself doing it still to this day. I mean, there's deep reflexive instinct that, yes, get them, because they've hurt, they've destroyed and done so many bad things, you know. And it just feels more just and fair, that whole eye for an eye mentality. You know, what goes around comes around, I guess, in that regard. But you know, we all want good to triumph over evil in the end. And the easiest, quickest way that happens for us in our world is mostly that eye for an eye mentality, you know. We're going to squash you and get back at you and that kind of thing. I mean, could you imagine if Iron Man just sat down and talked to his, you know, the evil doers in his films? I mean, could you imagine that Luke Skywalker, well, he did actually have a talk with his dad at the end, Darth Vader, come to think of it. But and he did forgive them. So forgiveness is kind of making some inroads. There are, you know, you hear about it more and more. There are some people who have been in the news who have suffered some just horrendous losses, and they would turn around and forgive the people who were responsible for those horrendous losses, for that great pain that they're suffering. You know, to forgive requires taking the high road. It's actually, if you have enough love and esteem for yourself, you're not going to want to feel victimized by those who have hurt you for too long. You know, it's kind of, it's, you're giving your power away to people who have hurt
right.
you if you can't forgive them. You're just giving your power away. Everything that they did to hurt you has total control over your life. You are always going to be reacting to life in terms of how they hurt you. And until you can really go back and look at it and forgive them, not just with your mind, because it's easy to forgive people with your mind, but with your heart as well. That's the really hard part. That's where you have to do a lot of evolving. And it comes back to that, what goes around comes around in this world, you know. Or what I really like, I think Jesus said this, is that what you sow, so shall you reap kind of thing. You know, the energy you put out into the world is the energy you're going to get back. If you're going to put out victimized energy into the world, you're going to get back victimized energy in the world. If you're going to put out forgiveness in the world, then you're going to get forgiveness back. I mean, how can you forgive yourself for all the things you did if you can't forgive others? And,
right.
You know.
Right. And vice versa.
Exactly. So if you know, the whole thing is, everybody's always talking, oh, you know, what a horrible place this place is, crazy, this world, you know, there's all this crazy stuff going on. But, you know, if we really want to make the world become a better place, we have to become better people. And I think that's best achieved with that whole compassion, gentle love, forgiveness, and compassion, which the spirit characters in the book are always trying to encourage Zoe Lynn to do, but she is like the rest of us, you know. She's just as oblivious. She doesn't remember why she was sent here. So it kind of goes in one ear and out the other.
Yeah. Well, I understand she has some problems with forgiveness. Can you talk about that?
Well, she, like I said, she's in the same boat as everybody else. Even though she had a mission coming into this world, she doesn't have any clue once she's born into this life. And the spirits that she encounters come and they try to remind her. But she, like all of us, you know, we come into this life and we're so deeply ingrained with the cultural values and belief systems of this life that we don't think there's anything beyond that. And so this is a story about beginning to open up to, yeah, maybe there's quite a bit beyond that. Maybe we should open up our everyday eyes and understand that this life and the cultural values in this life is not necessarily the end-all to be-all. In fact, it's not anything like that. So, you know, so instead of making the practice, instead of practicing forgiveness, especially an experience she had with her father early on over her developing sexuality, she ends up rebelling. And it has a big impact on how she lives her life. She rebels constantly. She uses all this energy for rebellion when she might have been able to live a much more constructive life if she had been able to forgive early on. But when you're a kid, you just don't have understanding of that kind of thing. You just get hurt and defensive, and you put up walls around you automatically that we carry around the rest of our lives until, if we want to be really conscious, we start to deconstruct them as we get older and more enlightened, hopefully.
Well, it's interesting, some of the things that you've said about forgiveness and the way Zoe Lynn acted it out. I know, belonging to 12-step programs in the AA Big Book, it talks about how resentment is the number one offender. And, of course, when we're doing that, we're withholding forgiveness and, as you say, only hurting ourselves. So that's such an important lesson to learn. And, of course, Jesus said that it's not just seven times you need to forgive, it's 70 times seven. So it is.
Yes, it's a constant battle.
It is. I mean, to get it, to feel it in your heart, as you say, we need to work at it. Practice makes perfect,
yes.
Or at least leads to progress. So now you talked about how the physical body is less than divine in the Western culture. Now, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, as I talked about earlier, you know, ever since the inception of the Judeo-Christian Bible and the dogma that surrounded it, there's kind of been a bad attitude about the physical body. Nobody's ever said the physical body is divine unless you were a follower of Tantrism, which they had a great thing about, you know, how sexuality leads to, you know, spiritual enlightenment. In fact, I'm just writing about this in my in the sequel to this first book. In the days of the goddess, prostitutes, sacred harlots, these people were highly revered because there was a belief that there was healing in a woman's vagina. I mean, they looked at sex a lot differently. Oh, yes, they did. They used sex in their celebrations, and it was a serious, solemn event, actually. But they if they had a priest and a priestess during, like, the spring equinox when crops were coming back to life again. They believed that this symbolic sexual act would help bring the crops back to life again, would help to propagate animal and human species, make everybody, you know, fruitful and multiply. So sex was a big part of that. And they had a totally different attitude about it than what the Christians, and even I'm not so sure about like I said, the Judeo part of it, but the Judeo part was a big part of really kind of destroying the power of the divine feminine.
Yes, it certainly was patriarchal.
Yes. Oh yes, yes, yes. And, you know, there's actually a developmental theory, I think it's from Eric Newman, and he talks about just the individual, how the individual, you know, first they come out of this dark void, and then they become very dependent on the mother. The mother is the most important force in their world. The mother feeds them. The mother, they came out of the mother's body, so everything is about the mother. And then as you grow older, you start to venture out into the world and you get to know the father a little bit better. And then by the time you get to an adult, you're supposed to take, you know, the mother and the father and integrate them. And I think that this is exactly what's happened in the history of the world. I think we started in this dark void and the mother was the most important thing. She gave life. So we worship the mother to crazy means. We always do things in extreme on this planet. And then, yes. Then we moved out. Then new information came along. Men learned that they were part of, you know, the reason that life was created. And they kind of took the ball and ran with it from then, and everybody went over to that side for a while. Even women, the thing is, women agreed to this. I mean, women went along with the men living out a totally diminished role from what they once lived as. And now I think we're getting to finally to the point where we're advancing and we're getting a little integrated now with the masculine and the feminine. We're still working on it, still having issues with some fundamentalist people who don't think women should have birth control. Oh, my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That's just crazy stuff. That's just crazy stuff. I think there's a backlash, and I think it's been happening the last several years, and I think it's just the last dying screams of the old way of living. You know, there's that last struggle at the very end before mm-hmm. death for some people. Yeah. But I think we're getting into a much more integrated society now. I mean, look at the stuff we're talking about.
Right. Well, it all starts with some dialogue, and that's what we need to do to get past some of the dogma that has been passed down that has kept us repressed. Now, you're talking about the physical body as being divine and yet not having been perceived that way. In the past, can you talk about the repercussions for women and their sexuality that we're still trying to recover from today?
Well, Miley Cyrus, I mean, everybody made a really big deal out about that. And, you know, for one thing, women of that age, or 20s, they're pretty sexual. they're kind of peaking sexual-wise, from what I understand.
Right.
And I understand why that happened. The thing is, we came from a very repressed, in the 50s, sexuality was very repressed. Women's sexuality, if women slept around, they were whores, which used to be sacred. But if men slept around, there was no repercussions for that. They weren't whores. They were just guys being guys kind of thing. So Madonna comes out. And Madonna's like in your face with her sexuality, in your face. I'm a woman and I am sexual and I'm just going to put it right in your face. And she influenced all these young pop stars, Britney Spears, probably Miley Cyrus, all these who all wanted to dance around in their underwear on stage, all wanted to be sexual, all wanted to get attention with sex. In this kind of repressed sexuality, women's biggest power is their sexuality. That's one of the things, that's the biggest power they can grab is their sexuality because there's so much repression with it, and they know they can manipulate people with it. But it's not a really very enlightened attitude towards sexuality at all. It doesn't really... I just read a book actually called Female Chauvinist Pig recently by a younger woman who interviewed a lot of younger women, and their whole this whole kind of after Sex in the City kind of somewhat semi-raunchy porn type acceptance of sex where they've actually adopted a lot of masculine values towards their own sexuality. And totally lost. We're still not in touch with the divine feminine as far as that. And with the divine feminine, you get sacred sexuality. You get, you know, if you have a partner who you're really in love with and you are able to open yourself to them in the act of sex, that is one of the most evolutionary forces on the planet.
Well, that to me seems to speak of what true intimacy is about. And the light bulb went off for me after having lived out a life of being compulsively sexual and not really connecting at an intimate level was that God can be present. So you talk about sacred sexuality. I think that a lot of people just are totally out of touch or would be absolutely aghast at the idea that God is present when two people are being physically and emotionally intimate.
They have a hard time. I mean, they're so conditioned to look at sex as something kind of seamy and nasty, so they get turned on by that. And when a lot of times when they're actually having sex with a person, instead of experiencing it as a spiritual experience, they got that old thing running through their mind that this is kind of nasty and shady and dark and that kind of stuff. 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, sadomasochism. I don't want to be judgmental, but to me, I didn't even bother reading it. I had friends that read it, and to me, it was just sad. I thought, really? But you know what? I think it's going to help people work out some issues with their sexuality.
Now, in the book, I understand that Zoe Lynn's spirit companions revealed to her some of the lost mysteries about human sexuality. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I kind of did already. I told you about the menstrual cycle, the lunar cycle. I told you about the cross dressers. What else? Oh, and also about St. Augustine.
Now, these are all things that come across in the book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and more.
Okay. Okay.
yeah. There's a lot about some ancient rituals and stuff. You know, Easter. Easter's coming up, not that far away from Easter. You know, the bunny rabbit in Easter actually was the goddess's, started out as the goddess's sacred moon hare. And there's a whole little mythology about that. All of the big Christmas holidays, big Christian holidays, are pagan in origin. Actually, the Christians took a lot of the most popular rituals of the goddess worship, and they put their own spin on them. One big example is the resurrection ritual. That we talk about with Christ. Most scholars and historians and theologians who have studied it believe that they took this from, you know, there were resurrection rituals going on all over the place during the spring equinox and in the world long before Christ was put on the cross and died and was resurrected. It was a part of their, the crops dying off in the winter and being resurrected in the spring. There was something else that just flitted right in my mind while I was thinking about that, and now I can't remember it. Just gone. What were we talking about? Okay.
Maybe it'll come back.
Mysteries of
human
sexuality.
You want to tell us a little more about Zoe Lynn?
Well, Zoe Lynn, she's kind of my alter ego. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley. So her story is somewhat autobiographical. I mean, actually parts of it are about me trying to shine a much more magnanimous, enlightened, forgiving light upon some of the things that happened in my own childhood growing up in the 1950s and 60s. As with everybody who grew up in that era, there's a lot of cultural forces also happening in her life that are looked at in a little bit different light than even the JFK assassination is looked on in a light that people don't talk about or haven't talked about too much, actually. There was actually prophecy long ago by Chief Tecumseh or Chief Tecumseh's brother that every president, U.S. president from Harrison on was going to die in office every 20 years. And it actually was true for a while. Reagan actually escaped it. Reagan would have been the next one. Yeah, but
That's
it was
right.
true for a long
yeah.
time. Yeah. So
close.
There's that kind of stuff going on in her life. But my underlying goal in creating the story around Zoe Lynn was to try to bring together all the things that I had read about and studied and learned from New Age mysticism to ancient history and mythology to the psychologies of Carl Jung and Wilhelm Reich and Erich Fromm, all the things that had had a profound impact on my life that had actually changed my life for the better. I tried to put it all together and look at if all of this that I had studied and read about and researched was true, then these were the implications for the things that happened in Zoe Lynn's life. I mean, and actually it's a very positive story. Even looking at the things that happened in the civil rights movements, and you know, there's a little thing about how rock and roll was really a gift of power from the black race to the white race, because as soon as the white race started picking up the black race's rock and roll, the black race started gaining power themselves. They started, the civil rights movement started. So it kind of looks at thing from a, it looks at the events of this world from a much more cosmic perspective, that, you know, stuff that looks really bad down here on the planet might have a overall beneficial underlying force.
Well, you talk about Zoe Lynn as being kind of like your alter ego. I'm just curious, in terms of your own spiritual journey, how that parallels Zoe Lynn's journey.
Well, she, let's see, what's the best way to, how should I approach this question? A funny thing happened writing this story. The spirit characters that I put into the book started to say things to Zoe Lynn that I was thinking they were talking to her, but they were really talking to me.
Okay. All right.
And I'd be so blown away by it that I would have to put my book down for a couple of weeks just to absorb it all. You know, I'd be writing this. The thing is, I got the idea for the spirit characters. Well, I used to see spirits when I was a little kid on occasion, so that helped me kind of flesh out what they look like to Zoe Lynn, which is just kind of essentially human beings that weren't solid but outlined in light.
Mm-hmm.
And then Robert Heinlein's book, Stranger in a Strange Land, when I read that first, I've read that like seven times over or something like that, but one of the times I read it right before I was going to start writing this book, you come across these conversations between angels in this book, and they're of a higher-minded nature, not involved in all the little petty goings-on, feelings and emotions that happen on Earth. So as I'm composing these spirit characters, I'm thinking at first, well, because I have a psychology background, that they're archetypes, but they quickly took on a life of their own, and I had to let go of trying to hem them in with archetypal characteristics and stuff like that. And they actually, everything they said to Zoe Lynn, and I'm thinking that they're talking about something that's happening a long time ago or something, all of a sudden I'd reread it and I go, oh my God, this is exactly where I'm at right now in my life. And I would just be so blown away by this that, and it's still happening. I mean, it's still happening. So this has been a very, very trippy experience for me as far as helping me to evolve, as, you know, aside from writing the story, which I hope is entertaining. It's pretty humorous in places and pretty magical and stuff like that, but it's really helped me flesh out some really deep-seated stuff in my own life.
Isn't that wonderful? Can you talk a little
yes
bit about your...
No.
Okay. What's the no part?
Well, it's hard. It's hard. I guess I'm just of a stubborn temperament. I don't know how many people would have the same experience, but it's hard to have your world constantly being sort of cosmically blown up, so you have to put it back together. It's like going through a series of little deaths constantly. And it's been really hard. It's been a really hard journey that way. But I am such a much better person than I used to be because of it. I'm just so much nicer and less judgmental and kind and gentle, much gentler than I used to be. You know, when I first started writing this book and the spirits are talking, at the first chapter is about... the second chapter, I guess, is about before Zoe Lynn came to this world. She's having this conversation with one of the spirits, Mercurio. He's kind of the head guy. He's the master of interstellar communications, and he's emissary from the Great Wing Council. And he's telling her about developing gentle love, compassion, and forgiveness and stuff like that. And, you know, I did have this intention when I'm writing about the spirit characters to... I did ask the forces of the universe for my highest good and when I was writing what they were saying, because I had to really reach to get beyond the pettiness of everyday earthling life. And I got what I asked for, and sometimes that's not an easy thing.
They say to be careful what you pray for.
Yes.
You might just get it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, funny thing, I was just watching a CD with Joseph Campbell. I don't know if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yes, well, it was one that I'd never seen before. It was about bliss, and he says there's an ancient test that says if you desire to seek nirvana as much as a man whose head is on fire desires a bucket of water, then go for it. But if you don't, then don't, because it's going to be too hard.
Mm.
And I guess, early on I kind of inadvertently stumbled into that. I kept wanting to know the truth of this life. I kept wanting to know the truth of this life. That was what I wanted more than anything in the world, to get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what I was getting into with that. And you just can't. But what it comes down to is you end up having to do, especially towards the end, a lot of, I would have to say, kind of tedious fine-tuning. That's really difficult. But at the same time that I'm cussing out all the forces of the universe going through this, I notice that I'm beginning to become more whole as a person. I'm beginning to feel more whole. I'm beginning to go, oh, okay, now I understand why I had to go through all that horrible stuff, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a tough journey.
Well, you know, I think the one thing about going through quote-unquote horrible stuff is that when we get to a point in our lives where we are feeling a sense of well-being, we can look back and not have to judge it as horrible, because it's been part of the process of evolving and growing and becoming the person that we are today, that hopefully we've come to embrace and love.
Thank you for reminding me of that, David.
That's okay. I need those reminders all the time. I've been through the fire.
Yeah,
I've experienced the dark night of the soul, and it's
fun.
Yes. It's no fun. Tell me a little bit about your writing process. How do you go about it? Does Do you map things out? Does it just flow through you? Talk a little
bit
about
of everything.
That, if you would.
A little bit of everything. You know, I start writing, and then, you know, depending on what I'm writing about, I have to stop and go, okay, now where do I want to go from this? And where do I want to go from this? And sometimes it just flows. It just flows like, oh, you're going to go from this to this to this. Other times I have to sit and think, you know, and I'll start writing and then okay, that's where it's going to go. And then I map out a little bit of it. I'm going to go from here to here to here to here. In the book, at the end of the book where she gets to her deep, dark secret, I had no idea that was going to come about until the very end.
That's when you discovered the secret yourself?
Yeah, I guess so. It had to do with an ancient past life she had on this world. You know, I remember originally the book was titled My 333rd Life on Planet Earth, and people... And it was a paranormal fiction, and people would ask me, they go, is this autobiographical? And I go, well, I'm not really sure. it's stuff that came out in me, you know, it's just stuff. I think I've been told some things about past lives that I had. Not too much of it is in the book, as far as what I've been told, but there's a lot of other stuff that came to me. I don't know why it came to me. I do have a pretty vivid imagination, but it seemed to work. So, you know, at the beginning of the book, I where it has all this disclaimers, you know, fictional characters and blah, 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 blah. And I wrote a sentence that it's based on this story was based on what Carl Jung would call active imagination, which is taking, you know, wounds of your life and writing about it in a very imaginative way and just letting it all come out and see how it ends up. And that's kind of what I did with this book, with these stories, actually.
Well,
and it's not
that
just
sounds
personal
fascinating.
Wounds. It's cultural wounds, too. Yeah.
Mm. It sounds like you incorporate so much into it. So thank you for sharing that. As a fellow author, I can relate to how your writing process is. Sometimes I just go with the flow, and it feels as if I'm just channeling something. I just sit there, and I'm in a trance, and it flows onto paper. And then I realize that the story is developing, and if I stop and think about it too much, then I have to map it out a little bit. But it's an interesting process. What are you working on at this point in time?
Well, I'm finishing up the second book. I think it's going to be called Zoe Lynn's Cosmic Headphone Still Plugged In. And the first book takes her up until just as she's about to enter high school. It starts from before she enters into this world to just before she's about to get into high school. And this second book is pretty much, from what I can tell, it's just about high school years. But those were pretty interesting years, being that they were 1967 to 1970. There was so many things going on in those 3 years. It's incredible our heads just didn't explode. I mean, just from the cultural changes and all the... I mean, I got to 1 year, 1968. I titled it the year of what the, you know, and then put the little hashtags and all that kind of stuff, because it was the most insane year ever. From a cultural point of view, that, you know, there were the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Kennedy. Johnson comes out, says he's not going to run for president again. There are all these really intense demonstrations from students and civil rights workers, all kinds of things going on. Russia invades Czechoslovakia. There's Arab hijacking planes. The French detonate their first atomic weapon. It's just insane. On top of, and you know, you're trying to, and Rosemary's Baby, the movie Rosemary's Baby, I don't know if you're familiar with the book.
Oh, yes, I've seen
came
it.
Out, came out the same month that Kennedy was assassinated. It was a really strange telling movie for the times, like, because there was this whole issue about theologians were actually wondering if they could really make the kind of God that the Christians had traditionally talked about relevant to that day's increasingly secular society. It just didn't make sense that this you know, almighty masculine God was down there controlling the lives of everybody and all that kind of stuff. It didn't make a lot of sense to people at that time. So there was that big Time magazine headline, "Is God Dead?" So much stuff was happening and changing in that era. So when I initially was going to write it, I was going to try to go like another, you know, 10 years, but because there's so much stuff happening in those 3 years, 67 through 70, it's just going to be about the high school years.
Okay.
Zoilin's high school years.
Well, where can people find your book and find out more about you?
Well, my website is www.aprich.net. And you can, you know, that's probably the best place to go to find out more about me. From there, you can link on to my Twitter, and which I've kind of been remiss in writing a lot on Twitter because I've been so busy writing the book I forget about all that little social promotions I should be doing, I guess. They're not my favorite thing to do. And so you can go to my website, www.aprich.net, and you can click onto my Twitter. I'm starting to pick it up again. I will also have a link to the radio show once that gets up and running, and there's also a link to Facebook, and there's some bibliographical I have a bibliography there of all the books that influenced the writing of Cosmic Headphone, or a good portion of them. Anyway, a good portion of the books that influence Cosmic Headphone. Also have some biographical information, and also have a couple of excerpts from the second book on the website as well. So, and then there's a link to Amazon.com. You can go to Amazon to purchase the book, or you can go into your local bookstore and order it if you want to support your local bookstore. Yeah.
Great. Now, tell us when your radio show is going to start, and just briefly, if you would, tell us what it's going to be about.
Well, it's going to be delving into the what I like to call the mystical other realms of the divine feminine, sacred sexuality, spiritual psychology, ancient mythology, and anything else that comes to me along the way, probably. It's called Cosmic Headphone Radio Hour. It's currently set up on Blog Talk Radio, and it's going to be on 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time Thursdays.
Great. Well, it's time for us
starting
to come to
Thursday.
A close. Great. That's wonderful. You must be excited.
Yeah, I am. I am, actually.
Well, I wish you well with it, and thank you for coming on the show today, Anne.
Thank you very much, David. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Well, now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks to find common ground and take it to the next level here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.